name is Meredith.
And my name is Dustin.
And we're the host of...
The Alexander Standard.
That's better. Inspired by Rex Factor Podcast, we rank all the successors of Alexander the Great. From Perdiccas...
To Cleopatra the Seventh.
After Alexander the Great died, shit really hit the fan.
Seriously, the Hellenistic world was a crazy place.
And we've got some crazy stories to tell you.
So please come check out our show, The Alexander Standard.
I'm Michelle.
And I'm Lucy.
Welcome to episode 2.
Episode 2 of Charles the Eighth. And I would just say in advance, it's a lovely spring day out there, and on the spring, a young man's fancy turns to chainsaws, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
That's what they're doing out there. So I'm afraid for a while, at least until the light goes, you're going to hear a bit of chainsawing.
Yeah, and from me, you're going to hear unnatural silences as I stop to cough and my voice goes weird. But we are good.
Okay.
It's still good. We're not professionals. We don't have a professional setup.
No, God, no.
Oh, no.
We're not professional historians. We're not professional broadcasters. I don't know why people listen.
When can we call ourselves historians?
I don't know. I always think podcasts are a bit like... punk music was in the 70s, because you didn't have to be able to play an instrument or be able to sing or anything, did you? You just got up on stage and did it, and podcasts are the same. You just get a microphone and get on with it.
I figure I can't really call us a historian until we actually get to go somewhere important, like Hampton Court, and actually touch one of the documents we are reading digitally scanned.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I could do that more easily than you can.
Yeah. But I feel like we are checking primary sources. So and we are hunting down information. We spend quite a lot of time doing the research. So when do you get to call yourself a historian? I don't know. I have a degree.
I've got one in very, very deep history. Geology.
Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, Charles the Eighth.
Charles the Eighth, we left him. He just put his dainty little toes on Italian soil.
Yes. And the Pope is like, no, the Ottomans are coming.
And we don't want you here anyway.
Yes.
Well, Innocent did.
Yes, he did.
Alexander, not keen.
No.
The estimates of the size of Charles' army vary wildly, as they always do. Maybe 30,000 plus Ludovico's army. But it's generally agreed that there were over 10,000 non-combatants they're dragging about with them. And they're not all prostitutes. I mean,
no, because you have cooks, laundry, they've got merchants there to purchase things. Yeah, forget that they bring like an entire little city in town with them. Blacksmiths,
yeah,
everything.
You've got the blacksmiths to do the armour.
And the horseshoes and farriers.
Yeah.
Were farriers an individual thing at the time yet? Or were they still the blacksmiths? I don't know.
What about vets? Were there anything... even akin to a vet, I don't know.
Oh, I doubt
it. Horses, or did you just go and whack them over the head with your sword once they...
Probably just put them
anyway,
out of their misery.
We don't know that.
Yeah.
But at the end, there are 15,000 non-combatants, so I don't know whether they were just both very rough estimates or whether they're picking people up as they go along. And I should imagine you probably would, because if you were sort of not doing great at home, you know, you might be one of the younger sons or something of a peasant, and the peasant might say, just tag along with that lot, don't you?
See what you can make of yourself.
Yes, one less mouth to feed, and you never know, you might do all right if you don't get killed.
Yeah.
I thought this was interesting. The difference between the French and other armies was that Charles's grandfather, Charles the Seventh, had changed the army from a feudal one, made up of men recruited by and following their local lord, to a maniacal army. Probably maniacal, but also monarchical, answerable to the king.
Which is only makes sense. You have one loyalty issue. That's it. You're just loyal to the king. You're not loyal to somebody else who might change their mind and wander off.
Yeah, this created a formidable army, but also paved the way to despotic kings. Mm. So whether this was why later in history you get a French Revolution but not an English one.
Well, you did get an English one.
Not for the same reasons.
No, and not the same result.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, this against this, you've got the officers of the army, which are made up of younger sons, raised on stories of chivalry in what was still a feudal society. So rather than being interested in modern warfare, they were sort of reckless and individualistic types.
That's helpful.
They were after personal distinction instead of playing for the team.
You get one person riding off in a different direction. They're toast.
Well, gunpowder, they thought, went against the military code.
Right.
And a gun was a weapon for wimps.
Oh, it wasn't for the
gentry. An infantryman killing the horse from beneath a nobleman was seen as a complete upending of the feudal hierarchy. And also, the French infantrymen weren't up to much, as Machiavelli thought that they were too servile. They didn't have enough initiative because they'd been downtrodden all their lives, more so than other peasants. So the design of the French army was looking to the future, but the actual combatants were stuck in the past.
Oh, dear.
Well, will this matter in Italy? Well, let's see. Well, no, because the Italian army was even worse.
Machiavelli's episode, pulling out her hair, like, just make a decision and go for it.
Well,
stop switching
also,
sides.
It's the condottieri.
Yes.
They rely on the condottieri. And, you know, they're not overly bothered about the chivalric aspect of killing a nobleman's horse. But also, they're fighting for money.
Yes.
So they might refuse to fight. They weren't given enough, or they might fight for the other side if they offer more.
Or, if you don't pay them, they just turn around and attack your own people.
Yeah, or they just go.
Yes.
Yeah, they're not fighting for glory, and the French sort of are. So that seems to make a big difference. Mm.
So the French basically have a bigger buy-in for a good result.
Yeah, also, I suppose, they're not on home territory, so they can't lose because they're stuck in the enemy's camp, effectively.
Right. If they lose, they're hooped.
Yeah.
So they're fighting literally for their lives so they can leave.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Good point.
Well, they do have mercenaries in the French army. They've got the Swiss. But they were pretty good. I mean, they'd honed their shock tactics, which was revolutionising warfare. And also, they were pretty nifty mountaineers. And when you think that the French had to cross the Alps to get into Italy, that was quite handy.
Now, if they had brought elephants with them.
Yes. Well, I suppose you've lost that element of surprise with the elephants.
Yeah, it's a little hard to hide them, paint them like cows.
But also, they'll be thinking, yeah, Hannibal did that. We've seen it all before. Well, the Swiss were originally brought in by Louis XI. Although Anne de Beaujeu got rid of them, feeling that it didn't do French self-respect any good to bring in foreigners. But Charles had the good sense to bring them back. And, you know, they were a godsend, really.
That's such an odd sentence to hear after reading about him with the Anne of Brittany episode. Charles had the good sense. Excuse me?
Well, someone had the good sense. Maybe it wasn't Charles.
Now, his Anne of Brittany did not approve of the Italian wars. Did Anne de Beaujeu?
No.
Okay.
No, pretty much nobody did.
Nobody did. Gosh, and you still did it.
And you still did it. It's got quite some gumption.
Stubbornness.
I mean, he's king, which helps. You know, he's not going to be ostracised, is he? I mean, it's
true.
But, yeah. Mm. Meanwhile, in Naples, they weren't overly worried. Because, as you said last week, Charles had to cross the Alps and then get all the way down Italy through hostile territory. The likelihood of him being able to do it was so remote that it was hardly worth worrying about. Just in case, though, Ferrante had positioned a fleet to occupy Genoa and to keep the French away from the coast. Naples had a good army because it had been tried and tested through various Italian wars. Everybody wants Naples. They had nothing to fear, they felt.
Huh.
But in the Lombardy archives, someone found a report that said that Ferrante was secretly beset with fears.
Really? Why?
He wasn't quite fearful of the French as such. He was more frightened that when the French came, his people, who hated him,
would turn on him.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a legitimate fear.
Yes.
Especially in Italy.
Yes. Yeah, boy, quite prescient, it turned out. Yes.
Oh, no.
So, yes, he did have something to fear. Not the French themselves, but what would happen if they did manage to make it.
Yeah, his people would just be like, yes!
Yeah. He died quite soon after, and Alfonso, his son, wasn't as detested as his father had been, but he still had to live with his father's unpopular legacy.
Oh.
So, I mean, people don't forgive you straight away, do they?
No.
Alfonso met Alexander VI on 14th of July and told the Pope of his plan for a concerted campaign. Now, this is very sensible. If they didn't all pull together, they risk losing the independence of Italy to a bunch of foreigners.
Yes.
He said to the Spanish Pope. So Alfonso proposed putting his fleet and army to be used for a common campaign, because he was presumably hoping that everyone would do likewise and they'd end up with an invincible army.
Yeah.
And the year before, Alfonso's uncle Federigo had gone to the Pope to offer him his daughter Sancha as a wife for one of Alexander's sons. You know, the other one, Geoffrey. If the Pope would only refuse to give the investiture of Naples to Charles, which he did.
Oh. Oh, right.
Apparently, Geoffrey gallantly consummated the marriage to Sancha, who was 3 years older, and Alexander wrote to Juan Borgia that, quote, he performed very well, notwithstanding he is not more than 13 years old, unquote. So there's a proud dad there.
Oh my goodness. Yes. That's a child.
It's a child. His dad seems to know how it went.
Gross.
And his dad's the Pope. I mean, there's so many things wrong with that situation.
No kidding. Ooh, yeah. Creepy.
Mm. Alexander was lukewarm about saving Naples, although obviously he didn't tell Alfonso that. But he did like the sound of using somebody else's army. I wonder, poor Alfonso, he said, yeah, I'm putting my army into the pot in the middle of the room.
Yeah, you put yours.
We all do that.
Yes.
We all do that. Where are you going with my army?
Yeah.
Alexander was particularly fed up with the Colonna family, who were really irritating him. Also, he was quite keen to get Caterina Sforza and her son out of Imola and Forli so that his son could have it. Thus it was that Alfonso's army was divided and sent off to places that were no help at all in keeping the French out.
Jeez.
So it was wasting time that could have been better spent.
Oh, these people.
But Alfonso planned to get his fleet to Genoa as quickly as possible, since if he could take that port, and if you look on the map, you'll see that it's Genoa is the first place you come to. If you cross straight across from France to Italy, it's the first port you could come to.
Well, see, I don't...
It's the shortest route.
The reason I'm about to say I don't know... Hold on, I need a map of Italy.
Yeah, I had to do it with a map the whole time, just to keep tabs on where they all were at any time.
Like... The question I have is, I don't know the route. Where are they coming across?
The first port of call is Turin. Once they get into Italy.
Okay.
So,
gosh, this seems like such a bad idea. You'd be better off to go on a ship.
Yeah. But then I suppose you've got to go past Sicily. And Sicily is Ferdinand of Aragon's.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yeah, you can't even do Sardinia because that's held by Aragon as well. Okay, yeah, there's not really another way to do that.
Well, I think the plan is to get the fleet to Genoa and work from there.
Right.
But Alfonso obviously realises that it would be the most sensible, so he decides to get his fleet there.
Right.
Alfonso of Naples. For some reason, I couldn't find out, there were delays getting the fleet ready to head off. And in that time, the Sanseverino family entered Genoa and ensured its loyalty with promises and bribes from Ludovica Sforza. Then, just before Alfonso's fleet managed to reach the port, Louis of Orleans turned up and sailed into the city with Charles's navy. And this would have been a huge blow for Alfonso. And he must have been furious that they'd spent so much time faffing about beforehand.
No kidding.
When Alfonso's fleet, headed by his brother Federico, moseyed up, expecting to be able to sail in without hindrance, they found a city garrisoned up to the eyeballs and an intimidating cluster of boats, superior to their own, waiting for them.
Oh, dear.
So Federico turned round and got out of range, which was very sensible. I mean, you don't want to lose your entire fleet right at the beginning of this war. But he decided to attack by land, since he'd been assured that the Genoese would go off to them at the drop of a hat. But he hadn't taken into account what a bit of Milanese bribery will do.
Right.
So it's all gone horribly wrong for Naples already.
Wow, you had all that time to make friends with everybody in between you, and you didn't.
People are like that, aren't we? We are just like that. I mean, you say we've had all this time to stop global warming, and we haven't.
True.
It's just the way people are.
Yeah.
Frustrating.
Well, first of all, you start with the, it's never going to happen.
Ah. Yes. But if you think in your own life, how many times you've thought, I had a week to do this. Why am I rushing to do it all now? Yeah. 5th September, Charles entered Turin, where the people greeted him and gave him the keys to the town and gifts of jewellery. And there were pageants representing the exploits of Charlemagne, which was a not-so-subtle flattery of Charles. The regent was Bianca. There's a lot of female regents and rulers in the Italian states.
Really?
Yeah, you got Caterina.
Yeah.
Isabella d'Este does some. I suppose because the men folk are quite often out fighting with other Italians.
Right.
But Bianca seems to be, well, she's a regent, so she's running the place. She gave over her palace to Charles, and she moved herself into the Episcopal Palace. I don't know what happened to the bishop. Shunted off somewhere. Unless they shacked up together, I'm not sure. She gave Charles 12,000 florins, which she'd raised by pledging her jewels, and got a loan of 30,000 florins from the bank, which she also gave him. So she just put herself hugely in debt.
Why?
Well, Turin is the first big city when you enter Italy from France, as I said.
Yeah.
So maybe she saw it as a good investment to keep the neighbours sweet. If it's going to start kicking off between France and Italy, they're going to be piggy in the middle, pretty much, aren't they?
Oh, okay.
You want to make sure that you can swing both ways, really, don't you?
I would just want to push them out as quickly as possible. Nope, keep going, keep going, keep going. Make the next person the piggy in the middle.
Yeah, a lot of people do that.
Yeah.
At Asti, there was something of a reunion. The Duke of Ferrara and Cardinal Giuliano della Rovere turned up, who's the future Pope Julius II. Duke of Ferrara is Ercole d'Este, and on our Patreon episodes, which will be coming out in April about Lucrezia Borgia, I will be telling you an absolutely mind-blowing fact about Ercole d'Este.
Ah, now I want to know.
But I'm not going to say it here. Louis of Orléans arrived with the good news about the Neapolitan fleet, you know, that they were there and that they managed to chase them away. Ludovico Sforza arrived with his wife, Beatrice d'Este, and 80 of her ladies-in-waiting. I don't know if Ludovico brought them because he knew of Charles's reputation.
Ooh, he's just going to give them a harem?
I don't know, is this a honey trap or... I'm not sure. But it just seemed odd to travel to what's potentially a war zone now with 80 ladies in waiting.
Wow.
So I did wonder if they were being set up.
Distract him?
It's all going swimmingly at the moment. But on the 14th, Charles fell ill. And he may have had a mild dose of smallpox. Some said it was a result of his dissolute life, although whether that meant liver problems from drinking too much or... the other thing,
syphilis,
which I'm hoping not to mention until we get to Naples.
Squishy sound effect.
Those on his own side who'd never liked the idea of invading Italy immediately said, "There you go. Oh no, the king's ill. Let's go home then." Oh, and pity, it was all going so well. Never mind. But Louis of Orléans had other thoughts about this. Without Charles rabbiting on about Naples all the time, maybe they could use this army just to pop over to Milan
and get
oust the Sforzas,
yeah,
and give Louis his birthright as the Duke of Milan.
Yes, through his mother.
Yeah. So how infuriating then must it have been when a couple of weeks later, Charles got better.
Darn it.
Yeah.
I was so close.
Yeah, so Naples it is then. They went as far as Casale in Piedmont, where Ludovico was keen to shunt Charles and his army through as quickly as possible, like you suggested.
Ah, smart man.
Yeah, he was very happy to have them as colleagues in his dispute with Naples, but he didn't want them anywhere near Milan.
No, not with Louis the 12th there. Well, sorry, Louis d'Orléans.
Charles did stop for a while, though, in Pavia, later to be the site of Francis I's capture and poor Richard de la Pole's death. He went to visit the Duke of Milan. And it's easy to forget that Ludovico isn't the Duke of Milan yet, but young Gian Galeazzo, who is lying ill at the castle in Pavia. And Gian Galeazzo's wife was convinced that Ludovico had poisoned him. But little Gian Galeazzo wouldn't believe this of his loving uncle. We saw this in Leonardo da Vinci's episodes, that he felt there was a touch of Stockholm syndrome there. Charles was very touched at the poor man's condition. Gian Galeazzo's wife was the daughter of Alfonso of Naples, and she threw herself at Charles's feet and begged him not to carry on to Naples, because that's her father they're about to going off to attack. Ludovico stood around feeling rather uneasy. Partly, he might have been worrying that Charles might ask him, "So what exactly is wrong with your nephew, then?"
Uh-oh.
Yeah. But more that, Charles was notoriously soft-hearted, and the entreaties of a woman could well turn him away from a project.
How can you be soft-hearted and go to war?
Yeah, he's a very complex man.
I don't understand that at all. I'm okay with killing you, but you begged me not to, so yeah.
And your wife begged me not to, yes. So perhaps I won't. But I am going to entirely obliterate this city.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, luckily for Ludovico, Charles was in too deep. He couldn't get out now. They not long left Pavia when they heard of the death of Gian Galeazzo. And Ludovico said that he had to rush back to Milan to organise the funeral because he loved that nephew of his.
Oh, so much.
Yeah, really, he needed to be there. To take over the dukedom. Yeah, dukedom. He didn't want anyone else muscling in while he was away, especially since Gian Galeazzo had a son.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. How old is the son, though?
Yeah, he's a little lad.
Oh, no. Does he survive?
I think so.
You think so? We didn't know. I would have immediately stopped my research and gone, please let the boy live.
Well, Ludovico pointed out that the French army is on the doorstep and these are dangerous times. Do we really want to entrust the duchy to a child at this moment? No? Right. I'm taking over.
Probably not.
And in fact, Ludovico had been in touch with Maximilian to get the investiture to become duke. And his diploma had arrived in the last days of Gian Galeazzo's life. So
he gets a diploma for being a duke?
You get a diploma for almost being a duke. It's not the investiture. It's a...
And why does Maximilian get to make this decision?
Because he's the Holy Roman Emperor.
Right.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But it turned out it was actually quite coincidentally... It had been quite fortunate for Ludovico that Gian Galeazzo had died when he did. So, you know, swings and roundabouts. The French invasion just gave the smokescreen of confusion and fear that Ludovico needed, really, I think. And if anyone's feeling sorry for Gian Galeazzo, I suggest you look at his portrait on Wikipedia.
Okay.
He looks like a puppy.
Aww.
Doesn't he? He looks so sweet.
Yes, he does. That does not look like a mean man. Aww.
Well, turns out he wasn't very nice. He was quite cruel to his wife.
Aww.
Yeah.
He looks like an angel.
He does. He really does. I've never seen anyone look so innocent. How can someone poison that? And also, to be fair to Ludovico, Gian Galeazzo might have died from acute gastroenteritis brought on by too much food and alcohol.
Oh.
But most people assumed it'd be poisoned.
I'm assuming poison.
Yeah. I think this is one of the more likely ones, but in Renaissance Italy, virtually everyone who died, people said, I bet they were poisoned. And whether Ludovico poisoned him or not, or whether he died of natural causes, shouldn't really be part of this story. Yet Charles's men believed in Ludovico's guilt, And they began to wonder about the moral rectitude of this man they had harnessed themselves to.
What is the moral rectitude of anybody you've harnessed yourself to, ever?
Well, they didn't think they could trust him to poison Jean Galeazzo, they said. I mean, he looks like a puppy.
Yes, you can't kick a puppy.
Yeah. But and what of their boss, Charles? I mean, why was he having anything to do with this murderer? As a monarch himself, surely it was his duty to get rid of Ludovico and bring back the rightful heir to the duchy, even if he was a child.
Because then we could help that child.
We could help the child, but also, I suppose, the child isn't the lawful heir, because Louis of Orléans really is. He's got the sorts of complete interlopers.
Yes, they are, and they really actually are.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So, I mean, either way, either the child or Louis, but not Ludovico. But Charles didn't do anything. In fact, he could see it as at the very least, a deflection from his goal, and at most, quite a dangerous thing to do. And they already had Naples, the Pope, and Florence against them. With Venice waiting to see which way the wind was blowing, they couldn't afford to turn Milan against them as well. Especially since they were going south, and their exit would be blocked off if Milan became hostile. They've got to think about how they're going to get home again.
Oh, yeah.
Later, when Charles and Ludovico had fallen out with each other, and these things are inevitable, aren't they? Charles then said, quote, "We found the former Duke of Milan, Giancarlo, convalescent and in fairly good health, but entirely bereft of liberty. And at Piacenza, and a day's distance from Pavia, Signor Ludovico told us that the said Duke of Milan was dead. Of what he had died, he did not say. Yet the end was sudden," unquote. So he had his suspicions, but had chosen to keep quiet about them so as not to rock the boat. It was at Piacenza that Charles received a visit from two of Piero de' Medici's cousins. And they assured Charles that Florence hated Piero, which it did.
Yes.
They said that Florence would love to side with France, and it was only Piero who was holding them back.
So get rid of him and you're good.
So Charles decided to pay Florence a visit.
Oh, dear.
The first Florentine place they reached was Vivizzano. It was called upon to surrender. It refused. And the majority of the people were put to the sword.
Oh, my goodness.
So when I said that Charles was soft-hearted,
no,
it doesn't stop him massacring an entire town. If the Council of Florence had got their act together, big if, they might have been able to put a stop to the French army before they really got going. After Vivizzano was a stretch of land that couldn't have provided food for the army for the length of time it would have taken them to cross it.
Oh.
If the Florentines had delayed the French there, the French wouldn't have been able to supply the troops and they would have had to turn back. It would at least have brought the Florence a bit of time. In the way of the route across was the fortified town of Sarzanella. If the Florentines had garrisoned it properly, it could have held the French up long enough there so that they couldn't have continued. But Piero de' Medici was indecisive at the best of times. He was definitely not in Team France. He'd been in collusion with the Pope. And like Ferrante of Naples, he knew his people hated him. And he was more scared of them than the French. Now, he remembered what his father, Lorenzo the Magnificent, had done when he was faced with a threat from Naples. And we heard about this in the episode we did on the Pazzi conspiracy. Lorenzo had headed down to Naples by himself, bearing nothing more than a book of his own poems, a large amount of money and jewellery to hand out as gifts, and his own charisma.
Yeah, I remember that, thinking, what are you doing? And it worked!
Yeah, at the end of the expedition, Florence and Naples were bestest buddies. Surely, Piero could do something similar with Charles. And I would remind you that Piero wasn't called the Magnificent.
Yeah.
He was called the Unfortunate.
Ooh.
Mm. So, Piero gave everyone the slip and bravely set off to meet the enemy cap at Pietrasanta.
Oh dear.
Requesting safe conduct. His plan was to storm into Charles's quarters, say, "Oi, Frenchie," and poking him in the chest with his finger, tell him a few home truths.
Really? That was his idea?
No.
Okay.
It wasn't. He didn't plan that. He planned to grovel to Charles to say he was really, really sorry and to beg forgiveness. And if they surrendered unconditionally, could he, Piero, still stay in power, please? Piero had given Florence an undertaking that he wouldn't accept any terms from Charles that were detrimental to the Florentines. What Piero agreed to was the surrender of several strategic cities for the duration of the war, to recall his troops from Romagna, to lend the king 200,000 ducats,
oh my goodness,
and to be taken into the king's protection.
Oh my goodness.
In fact, the French negotiators hadn't expected to get half of that and were completely bowled over by Pierre eagerly saying, yes, okay then, but I can't carry on being ruler, right?
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, the problem with Piero's plan to emulate his father was that he didn't have lots of gifts and money, he didn't have a book of his own poems, and he certainly didn't have charisma. Piero was then sent back to Florence. And what happened to him we covered in our Patreon episode on Pico della Mirandola. But suffice to say, that was the end of the Medici in Florence for a time.
Yeah.
Piero found himself very unwelcome and had to leave. Quite quickly. Charles and his men carried on marching. And on the 8th of November, they reached Pisa, where they were greeted as liberators.
Wow.
Yeah, Pisa was under the yoke of Florence, and it didn't want to be. Florence had treated them quite badly.
Right.
They knew that if they could free themselves from Florence, not only would they have their autonomy, but Florence would lose its access to the sea, since the Arno flows out.
Right.
Pisa. So the keys of the city were handed over to Charles by the Archbishop, and he was given use of the Palazzo Medici in Pisa. And people begged Charles to help them ditch Florence. Well, Charles had actually come to India. Charles had actually come to Italy to free people from tyrants and to use it as a springboard to attack the Ottomans, and for no other reason. But was the freedom of Pisa really his to give?
What? But
Charles, as we've said, is a soft-hearted old thing, and he couldn't listen to a sob story without being profoundly moved, and he said yes. And in an instant, Pisa erupted into a spirit of carnival. And any Florentines in the city had to run for their lives.
Oh, gosh, I can imagine.
You don't want to be there when regimes suddenly change.
No.
Florentine flags were taken down and French ones were put up. Florence was in a difficult situation. I think I might just as well put that on copy and paste, really, because every time we come to Florence, it's in a difficult situation. The French were coming. Piero had promised them everything. It turned out they no longer had Pisa, not sure how that had happened. And they didn't know whether France was coming as friend or foe. And the apprehension went the other way too. Charles wasn't sure what his reception was going to be like in Florence. He'd been assured that the city was pro-French, even if Piero hadn't been. So on the 17th of November, as Pico della Mirandola was breathing his last somewhere in the city, having been poisoned, Charles entered as a conqueror, and was very gratified and presumably relieved to hear chants of long live France.
Wow.
The Florentines were so glad to see the back of the Medici that they fell in love with the French, and we heard that some of the French soldiers were billeted at the Palazzo Machiavelli, and that the Machiavellis had been very apprehensive about it, but the soldiers behaved very well.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah. Well, those did. The ones at the Palazzo Machiavelli. I don't know if everybody was so lucky. But by a strange offshoot of Pierre's abject grovelling to Charles, he seems to have done himself a favour. Charles, with all that chivalric literature coursing through his veins, felt that Piero had thrown himself on his protection, and the king did vow to protect him.
Really, he's going to follow through with his vow? That's a surprise too.
Well, that's what chivalric knights do.
Yeah, I suppose so.
I mean, he's playing out a chivalrous...
A fantasy.
Yeah.
Dead people that he's killing.
Yeah.
It's not a nice fantasy.
No. But it's nice for him, because it seems to be working.
Yeah.
Medici supporters asked Charles if Piero could come back and explain himself to the king. And this put the Florentine council in a tricky position. They're in a difficult position again.
Again? Well, yeah. They just basically booted him out.
They booted him out and... That's the last thing they want, is to have him back.
No kidding.
And they were worried that if he came back into the city, there'd be an uprising. And with so many armed troops billeted about, it could get quite nasty. but they didn't want to offend Charles by telling him he couldn't give Piero a fair hearing. It is extraordinary what panic the return of one man can cause. In fact, the change in the atmosphere of the city made the French quite jittery. They couldn't believe that the city would go into meltdown just because of Piero. They were worried it was more than that. And, you know, they were worried that they'd been caught in the city.
And couldn't get out.
Now? So Charles said, fine. I thought Piero ought to get a fair hearing, but, you know, if you feel like that about it, let's drop the whole idea. Which I think is to Charles's credit. I mean, some rulers might have said, I have spoken and I will not change my mind.
Yeah. Maybe he recognised the danger he was in?
Might have done that. But no, Charles just said, no problem. If you don't want him, we'll have him. And maybe that's why people said he was indecisive, but it did prevent a riot.
Yes, that could have killed him.
Yeah. Although, I should imagine the French were better armed than your average Florentine citizen.
Yeah.
But the king then said, could you lend me 150,000 ducats?
And by could, I mean give me.
Yes. But it's interesting, it's a loan, not a demand. But we know, having done four episodes following Machiavelli traipsing backwards and forwards between Florence and France in his role as mediator, that Florence doesn't like being asked for money.
No.
And they said no, too much money. Charles said, but that's my demand. And Florence said, no. And Charles said, give me the money, or we will blow our trumpets, meaning we will get the troops out. And Piero Capponi, who was a member of the council, took the paper the demand was written on and tore it up in Charles's face. And said, quote, blow your trumpets if these are your demands, and we will ring our bells, unquote, meaning we'll get all the people out to fight. Interestingly, Charles had come across Capponi in France and had liked to admire him. And apparently Charles laughed and said, all right, fair enough, let's discuss terms. Both of these incidents give an insight into Charles's personality. But was he indecisive or just realist, not dogmatic? Yeah, I mean, I find it quite an endearing trait, but some might think that if you're king, you should call the shots.
Yeah, but at the same time, he's in an untenable situation if everybody starts turning on him. Yes, he could then wipe out the population, but how many of his army will it take? And then he'd never get to Naples.
Yes. Yeah, he does seem quite pragmatic about not doing things that he thinks will deflect him from his ultimate goal.
Yeah.
He just says, well, just leave it. We'll carry on.
Yeah.
He's quite single. Well, I say he's quite single-minded. He's there with everybody else telling him not to go. He's very single-minded.
He's very single-minded. Yeah.
So by November the 25th, France and Florence had a treaty. And Charles starts safe bloodshed and weeks of wrangling. They would have held him up. And they both got what they wanted without trouble.
Yeah.
Some strategic towns were to be in French hands, mainly to give him safe passage across Florentine land. But these places were to be handed back to France without prejudice, should Charles's enterprise fail. So it seems odd to write into a treaty, you know, if this doesn't work out, you can have them back.
Yeah.
It does seem quite pragmatic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, I'm hoping it'll work. But if it doesn't, you know, fair dues.
It's weird. It's sensible in such an insensible thing to be doing.
Yes, and given the descriptions we had of him, you know, just going with whatever the last person said.
Yeah.
He does seem to be making a lot of right decisions. Obviously, the last person he talks to is making the right decisions.
Which mistress?
Yeah. As for Pisa, Florence undertook to pardon them for their rebellion and to treat them better in future. And I think Pisa was hoping for more. The French had certainly given them reason to hope for more.
Yeah, they wanted independence.
In the meantime, Naples was moving their army around, but they didn't make a decisive blow. The French were reluctant to engage since they had fewer troops than Naples, which makes it stranger that Naples didn't make a move when they had the chance, because the French army was growing all the time. They were getting constant reinforcements being sent over from France.
Right.
Caterina Sforza's fortresses were being attacked. She had sided with Naples, but when she called for help from them, they didn't do anything.
Of course they didn't.
Yeah, so once her fortress in Mardano had been stormed, plundered and burnt to the ground, Still without Naples lifting a finger to help, she announced that she was now siding with the French. And the Neapolitan army fell back to Rome. They were rather foolish there because we learnt in Caterina's episodes that she was in quite a strategic position.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants Forli and Imola because it's sort of right bang splat in the middle.
Yeah.
Between everybody. While he was in Florence, Charles issued a manifesto. Number one on his list was to free the holy places and to relieve Christendom from the menace of the infidel. And in the pursuit of this holy purpose, he needed to occupy the kingdom of Naples, which of right belonged to him. Which does make it sound now as if the occupation of Naples is very much an adjunct to the main part of sticking it to the infidel.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think somebody has put spoken a bit of spin on that. Yes. I think it'd be better, really, if we put infidel number one, Naples number two.
Yeah.
But that's not what we're doing. Yeah, but let's tell the people that. Charles made it clear to the Pope that he must stop fighting the Colonna family, even though they're making perfect nuisance of themselves and had taken over Ostia, depriving Rome of its ports, because Charles told Alexander that the Colonia were in his pay, so, leave them alone.
Uh-oh.
Popes, on the whole, don't like people dictating terms to them.
No, they do not.
No. Mm. They've still got the chainsaw in their hand and they're eyeing up another tree.
Oh, no. Yeah, well. Shall we take down two? I really like chainsawing. How many can we take down today?
The Italians began to feel that Charles had luck on his side. And if I believed in luck, I think I'd agree with them. They had been banking on autumn being rainy, as it usually was, and this would make the roads impassable and stop the French in their tracks. Only 1494 was exceptionally dry.
Oh no, of course it was.
So it seemed as if nothing would stop the French. And in fact, they travelled so fast that they were in Acquapendente on the day a wedding was taking place in the Farnese family. And no one had any idea that the French were so close. And Giulia Farnese was there. And the name might not ring any bells, although she will come up quite a lot in the Lucrezia Borgia episode, but she was Pope Alexander's mistress.
Mistress.
The one who posed as the Virgin Mary in the mural. And she was on her way back to Rome when she was accosted by French soldiers, which is not good.
Mm. No.
The Pope was frantic. He really does seem to have been very fond of her.
Yes.
I mean, she was young and beautiful, and he was old and gouty and probably worse. So, he probably had every reason to be rather fond of her.
Mm-hmm.
She was in the hands not only of the enemy, but, of common soldiers. Anything might happen to her. In fact, what did happen was that the soldiers provided an escort to make sure she got home safely.
Really?
Mm.
How'd she manage that?
I'm not sure. This time, apart from the city that it got massacred, the French seemed to be trying to win hearts and minds. But I read a later version when I was researching Lucrezia Borgia that a ransom was demanded for Giulia, but Alexander swallowed his pride and asked Ascanio Sforza and San Severino to help, despite the fact that they were his enemies.
I need money. My lady's in trouble.
Yeah, and they did help, and Giulia was then delivered safely to Rome.
What did they demand?
Well, nothing as far as I can make out. But it must have been pretty humiliating for Alexander to have to ask the enemy to intervene so that he, the Pope,
could keep his
girlfriend back.
Yeah.
And Ludovico was apparently furious when he heard what Ascanio and San Severino had done. So I'm guessing that they didn't ask for anything and they damn well should have done, because Ludovico says, quote, "These ladies were the hearts and eyes of the Pope. They would have been the best whip for compelling him to do everything they wanted of him.
Yeah.
For he couldn't live without them," unquote. And I don't know what Charles would do if he'd known that Lucrezia Borgia was in Pesaro and the French went straight past there on the way to Rome. She would have been a useful whip to make the Pope comply.
She would have.
Because he did love his daughter. Charles had decided he wanted to spend Christmas in Rome. Nice place to spend Christmas. But to get there, he had to pass through Orsini country. And the Orsini and Colonna families were deadly enemies, notoriously so. So the Orsini could surely be relied on to stop the French in their tracks. Instead, Orsini fortress after fortress just opened their gates to the French.
What? Why?
It's very hard to know. There was panic in Rome as the French grew closer, obviously. With Ostia in the hands of Colonna, the city was effectively besieged, and it was beginning to run out of food even before the French arrived. Alexander seemed to be all over the place, changing his policies constantly. He received the envoys from Charles, but then wouldn't talk to them.
What?
He made plans to get in stores, shore up the walls, generally getting ready for a lengthy siege, but at the same time he was packing up all his valuables and saddling his horse ready for a sneaky getaway.
So he's indecisive.
He's indecisive. I mean, yes, you might want to make sure that Rome was okay, but, you know, I'm not stopping for good grief. It's really dangerous here.
Wow.
But then he heard that the Neapolitan army was near Rome, which gave the Pope new courage. And so he sent the French envoys away. Don't need you. Got Naples. Naples is coming to sort us out. He arrested people, including Ascanio Sforza. Yeah, after all he did for him, getting his girlfriend back. But then panic seemed to set in and he let him go again.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Alfonso of Naples then invited the Pope to Naples. But Alexander dithered. If he left Rome, how long would he stay Pope? Would Charles put another Pope in his place? And Alexander had a horrible feeling that would be Cardinal della Rovere. So he was thinking, well, anything but that. Charles didn't quite make it there for Christmas, but on the last day of 1494, he rode into Rome with practically his entire army. The Pope retreated to the Vatican, where there was a covered passage to the Castello Sant'Angelo, should he need extra protection. And things could have got nasty for Alexander, because Charles definitely has the upper hand. He's in this place with his army. No one had prevented him just riding in.
Jeez.
But luckily, I mean, he was a Catholic. He had a respect for the papacy. Whether he had a respect for that particular Pope, we don't know, but he had a respect for the institution of the papacy. So, but Charles's terms to Alexander were, 1, a right of free passage through the Papal States with permission to purchase supplies at fair price and some guarantee for his lines of communication, because that's vitally important. He's going down through Italy. He needs to know he can get back.
Yeah, he's halfway down.
Yeah.
That just seems insane.
Mm.
Like, you managed to do it.
That's what everybody said. 2, acknowledgement of his entitle to the throne of Naples. And 3, he wanted Prince Jem. And I'm not going to say anything about the third one because in this episode, because we'll have a cameo of Prince Jem just after this one, and it will all become clear.
Mm-hmm.
The outcome of the negotiations was that the French were to have safe passage. The cardinals, lords and cities who had gone over to the French cause were pardoned. Cesare Borgia would accompany Charles as papal legate for 4 months. And Prince Jem would be handed over to Charles, but Alexander would keep the money for him. Again, that will become clear in the cameo episode. On Charles's side, he agreed to make an act of filial obedience to the Pope, and he'd leave the keys of Rome under the mat on his way out. So I think he's done quite well.
Yeah.
The entitlement to the throne of Naples was quite confusing, because nothing was said outright about it.
Oh.
It was understood that the Pope promised to let Charles be crowned, provided that the coronation were not invoked as an adjudication upon the title of the throne, by which I think they mean, if the Pope allowed Charles to be crowned, he was not necessarily admitting his right to do so.
That makes no sense.
Well, I think Alexander wanted to leave his options open in case Charles should fail in his mission.
Yeah, but Charles, he has an army in your city.
Yeah, but as the Pope, if you're a Catholic, that means a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah.
He wouldn't want to agree that the throne was Charles's, only for Charles to be killed in battle, and Alfonso to come knocking at the Vatican door saying, what's all this I hear about Charles being the rightful king of Naples? But Charles had got pretty much what he wanted. I mean, the only way he could have done better would be to use force, and his standing back home would have plummeted if he'd, you know, held a dagger to the Pope's throat.
True.
The King and the Pope seemed to become best of friends while Charles was in Rome. Charles left Rome on the 28th of January, 1495. And the following day, 2 envoys from Spain arrived to tell Charles that he had broken the Treaty of Barcelona by his seizure of Papal States and by his violence towards the Pope. I'm not sure what sort of rumours had been getting out, or whether it was quite useful for Ferdinand of Aragon to make out that he'd been violent to the Pope.
And Charles is saying, excuse me?
Yes. No, we had tea. Yeah. What you heard about.
I met his mistress.
Yes, lovely lady. Apparently her hair reached the ground.
Wow.
Mm. I find that very unlikely. Yeah, if Charles marched into Naples, he would have Ferdinand to answer to. And Charles was annoyed and confused. Hadn't he bought Ferdinand off with Cerdanya and Roussillon before he left?
Oh,
that was
right,
the deal.
He gave him two towns, areas.
Hmm. With the deal, just leave us alone. I'm going to Naples.
Yeah.
2 days later, news was brought to Charles that Cesare Borgia had disappeared. And it turned out that he had disguised himself as a groom, had lowered himself from the walls and galloped back to Rome. And it also turned out that his real luggage had never left Rome, and that the luggage on the baggage train was full of stones.
Okay, why?
So this had obviously been planned all along. He wasn't going to spend 4 months with Charles going down to Naples. He had other things to get on with. So Charles wrote to Alexander demanding the immediate return of Cesare, and the Pope denied all knowledge. So Charles said, quote, "What dirty dogs these Italians are, and the Holy Father is as bad as the worst of them," unquote.
Agreed.
I think Charles underestimated Alexander. I'm not sure whether that's the innate belief in the Popedom. You know, if you can't trust the Pope, who can you trust? But I don't think he realised he was dealing with a man with no scruples whatsoever.
None. Absolutely none.
Yeah. But better news came to Charles soon after. Alfonso had abdicated from the throne of Naples on having heard that the Pope had sided with Charles.
Oh.
And he seems to have had a nervous breakdown.
Oh.
His dad was beset by terrible dreams, and he's had a nervous breakdown. Seems maybe there's a family problem. He was seeing visions of his late father predicting doom.
Oh.
That's not good.
No, that is not.
Yeah, we're going to do cameos on father and son, because I think they're both quite interesting. Not nice, interesting. Philippe de Comines, the chronicler, said that it was because he always was a poltroon, which just seemed to be taking the argument to the lowest common denominator.
We need to bring that word back.
Yes. That's a poltroon. Alfonso's son, Ferentino, which I presume means little Ferrante, was more popular than he was. So he thought he might have more of a chance against the French. He was less likely to have the Neapolitans turn on him. So okay. I think Alfonso was saying, over to you, son. You give it a go.
And his son starts having hallucinations of him and his dad.
Well, now it's Charles against Ferentino. Charles's army continued to march south, exhibiting a ruthlessness as they went that sent shockwaves across Italy.
Oh, dear.
At Montefortino, a city belonging to Jacopo Conti, who had taken French money and then sided by Alfonso, the French army decimated the city.
Yeah.
And by decimated, I don't mean every tenth person. I mean
wiped
everybody.
Out.
Yeah. Monte San Giovanni was said to be impregnable, but they had never seen anything like French guns, and it actually took less than an hour to take the city.
Holy cow.
Envoys had been sent to the city to demand they open their gates and bring out all their food, and the good folk of Monte San Giovanni had cut the ears and noses off the envoys and sent them back to Charles.
Oh my god.
So it was pretty clear from that point that the French would show them no mercy.
Yeah, you don't do that.
They did spare the women and children, so, you know.
Did they actually spare them? What did they do to them before they spared them?
I don't know. But the psychological effects on the Italians can't be overemphasised, I don't think. The French army seemed to be invincible. And once that idea had set in, everything just crumbled. There was a complete lack of confidence.
Yeah.
And garrisons were abandoned and gates were thrown open. It wasn't just Savonarola who was convinced that Charles had God on his side.
Wow.
I mean, that was the only explanation.
For some reason, when I was doing Anne of Brittany, I thought this was going so much more poorly for Charles. I didn't spend much time going into it because I was looking at her. But from all of her stresses and worries and communications, it sounded like it wasn't going well. And this seems to be going all his way.
I think the communication problem, maybe it's just happening too quickly.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
This is really surprising to me.
Well, indeed, yes. On the 14th of February, Valentine's Day, Charles was able to write back to the Duke of Bourbon, that's Pierre de Beaujeu, that he'd left in charge of France, from San Germano, saying, in effect, here I am in sunny Naples.
Wow.
And this amazed everyone. He'd got across the Alps, he's made his way right down Italy, and he was there. I say right down Italy. Naples is a huge place, so it's still only about halfway down Italy, but he is in Naples.
He did it.
And Ferentino fell back to Capua, where he made an attempt at resistance, but he was soon called back to the capital, which was on the brink of revolution. And no sooner had he gone than Capua rose against him.
Oh, dear.
Mm. So the French entered Capua on the 18th, and back in Naples the government had ceased to function, and the city was overrun by mobs shouting, France, France, and looting the Jewish and Moorish converts in that lovely way that mobs do. On the 20th, Charles sent a message to Naples demanding their surrender, and the Neapolitans were delighted. They felt they weren't capitulating. They were being freed from a tyrannical regime, just as Charles had planned all along.
Yeah.
They asked him to wait so that they could greet him in splendour. But Charles couldn't wait, and he rode into the city of Naples without any ceremony at all on the 22nd of February, 1495.
Wow.
He's done it. And the following day, Ferentino sailed for Ischia with his family.
Where is Ischia?
I'm not sure, actually. It must be an island.
Oh, it's a little island just off of Naples. It's tiny. Like, just off of Naples city. It's this little tiny island.
I suppose he wants his family to be safe, but he also doesn't want to be too far.
Just in case things go wrong.
Yeah, so he's presumably hoping to get back. Even though few of his officers stayed loyal to him, the most loyal, the Marquis of Pescara, and he was holding the Castelnuovo, Newcastle. He was told to surrender it within 20 hours, or the whole garrison would be put to the sword. And he replied, wow. He meant to hold out for 20 hours, 20 days, 20 months, 20 years, and indeed as long as he should live, for his great loyalty to his king and to the House of Aragon, under which he had been born and bred. For he desired to exhibit in his own person such a loyalty as could not be matched in all Italy. And then he quietly sneaked out of the castle and ran away as fast as little legs would carry him. So those are the sort of people that Ferentino have got backing him.
Hold on, I'll put it on a recording so you think I'm here. Yes. Got a little way. Jeez.
So, did Charles win or did the kings of Naples lose? People were very keen to surrender and welcome the French. And that's not just Neapolitans, it's all the way down. Francis Bacon said, quote, he had conquered the realm of Naples in a kind of felicity of a dream. He passed the whole length of Italy without resistance, so that it was true, which Pope Alexander was wont to say, that the Frenchmen came into Italy with chalk in their hands to mark up their lodgings, rather than with sword to fight, unquote. Well, I'm not sure the people of Fivizzano would agree with that, but
no.
It does seem that a lot of people capitulated, and they weren't all, and you can't blame the tyranny of the Neapolitan kings for all of that.
No, but it sounds like there's tyranny all the way through, that people are that dissatisfied. They've been constantly at battle. If they're all under the French monarch, then maybe we can stop fighting.
Yeah, and when places are embattled like that, their leaders ask for a lot of taxes to pay for it as well.
Yes.
And they really began to feel that Charles's victory was ordained by God. There was no other explanation for it. And
there's plenty of explanations for it. You just don't want to acknowledge them.
You don't want to go against God.
No, but still, wow.
A chronicler, De Conti, said that Charles, who had no footing in Italy and had never marshalled an army on the field of battle, that's not strictly true, he had fought in Brittany, had traversed in triumph a kingdom strong in men, in horses, and in warlike arts, quicker than a peaceful traveller could have walked through it. He doubted not that future ages his story would seem to be an invented tale rather than a statement of fact, unquote. And when you think of the descriptions of him that we were given at the start of the episode, when we were told he was ugly, ill-educated, useless, indecisive.
Fragile,
yes. It's worth remembering all that when we come to rate him. Comine said, quote, "The conquest of Naples was no work of human hands, but was an operation proceeding from the divine omnipotence," unquote. Because Comine had a pretty low opinion of Charles, so he doesn't seem able to believe that he could have pulled this off without the help of God.
Wow.
Charles and his men were really impressed with Naples, and also with Mount Etna that was spewing out smoke. One of these men waxed lyrical about it all, especially the food and wine, and, quote, "The people are fairly pleasant, and feel, or feign, affection for us. But one has to be careful about making love to their women folk, for some of them are very jealous. However..."
Oh, wow.
"However, we must teach them French ways, which indeed they are already beginning to learn," unquote. And all of the listening several will have known that we'll get to this point sooner or later. Must be getting a sense of some foreboding.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I mean, perhaps we ought to have a syphilis gong.
Yes.
Because all this teaching them the French ways...
gave them the French pox.
Yes. Or the Italian pox, if you happen to be French. People writing back to Anne of Brittany stressed that Charles was longing to see her and was hoping to start heading home as soon as possible, and that he hoped to be back in France by April. But Charles fell ill soon after arriving in Naples and wrote to Pierre de Beaujeu, quote, "I beg leave to inform you that, as though smallpox did not suffice for the beautifying of my appearance, I have now had measles. But thank God I have got over them," unquote. Although there is some doubt that it was measles.
Oh.
They then set about denuding Ferentino's castle of all their gold and costly silks and cloth of gold and Venetian glass and tapestries and weapons and wine and wine and more wine. And so this was all loaded onto the baggage trains to be taken home. Ferentino's uncle came to Charles and asked him if his nephew could please keep the title of king. They're so naive, these people, aren't they?
No! No, he cannot.
Charles told him that his people had looked into this. Yeah, my legal people, we've all looked into this. And it turned out that the House of Aragon had illegally usurped the throne of Naples. So, you know, who knew? So, No, in a nutshell, Ferentino could not call himself king.
I can't believe they even asked.
Yeah. But if they cared to come to France, he would be given a pension of 60,000 livres a year.
He really likes to give out pensions when he has no money.
Yes. The command of some gendarmes, people of arms, I must admit that was the first time I realised that the French police gendarmes were gendarmes, people of arms. I've never thought of that before.
Oh. Neither have I.
Yeah. And a suitable marriage alliance. And the uncle said he'd talk to Ferentino about the offer and would get back to Charles, but Charles never saw him again. So I got the impression this wasn't a trap. Charles would have done all that. He'd have given him what he promised. It seems more Charlesy. I mean, it'd be Ludovico Sforza or the Pope. You knew that they would turn up and they would never be seen again. But I feel a gut reaction that Charles would have given him everything he promised. Charles decided that his priority was law and order and getting rid of the suffering brought by oppression. He reduced taxes, which is always popular, as long as you don't bankrupt the country, and got rid of monopolies. He sent back to France for lawyers and judges who were prepared to work in Naples. But John Bridge, who wrote pretty much the only books in English that I could find about Charles, says of this attempt, quote, "To the reorganisation of his newly won kingdom, Charles brought his amiable intentions, by which he was generally actuated, coupled with the infirmity of purpose that so frequently deprived these intentions of any effective realisation," unquote. So he was he's full of good intentions, but they never quite come off.
Ah.
He felt really sorry for the oppressed kingdom. You know, if the people of Naples were his only concern, he'd probably have made a very popular king of Naples. But he had other considerations. He had the people of France. He had his own men who'd accompanied them there. He needed to be secure on the throne, especially if he wanted to be home by April. And for that, he needed money. And for all that talk of cutting taxes, it was all well and good, but he needed money now.
Which means taxes.
Yes, and even worse, he demanded the April tax be paid there and then, which is a bit of a turnaround, because it's only February.
Oh.
So not only is he changing his mind about having taxes, but he's saying, yeah, I want it well in advance. Instantly, his popularity took a downturn.
You think?
Charles had never really run a country, because the Beaujeaus had run France. And
right.
Then Charles had been too busy planning his Italian trip to worry about the day-to-day running of France. That was somebody else's problem. And another bone of contention was Charles filled all the government posts, bar one, with Frenchmen. So,
yeah, that never goes over well.
No, the Neapolitans are not being governed, not governing their own country anymore. Moreover, the French soldiers apparently felt contempt for a people who'd given up so easily.
Oh dear, that doesn't go over well either.
No, well, they didn't feel they had given up. They'd given up the House of Aragon.
Yeah.
But that's because they were tyrants. And effectively, they felt they were fighting on the same side. And what really galled the Neapolitans was that the French were just plain rude to them. And it was surprising how quickly the honeymoon period was over.
How long?
I think we're talking weeks.
Oh.
And not that many weeks, come to think of it. I mean, if it was in February, they only arrived at the end of January. We're talking about days, in effect, come to think of it. There was little discipline. As Caterina Sforza had complained, quote, "The French, for all they are our allies, are of a bestial nature." Ooh. I should say, we don't think this now. And so devoid of discipline that they pay no heed to their officers and leaders, who, as I know, are much displeased by their excesses, unquote. And that was before conquest had made them smug. Charles had promised his protection to the Jews and Moors in Naples, but had been unable to stop his men from looting them. And although Machiavelli might have said they were well behaved in Florence, they did not behave well once they were billeted in Naples. They took the best rooms, they ate and drank all the provisions, and the women of the house had to be very much on their guard.
Wow.
One correspondent said that everyone was so disgusted by their behaviour that the Turk himself would have been more welcome.
Wow.
Mm. We've mentioned on several occasions that the soldiers put it about a bit, shall we say, when they were in Naples, and their king was no better than their men, his men. He was even known to have sex with nuns.
Mm. Voluntarily?
Don't know. Well, he was voluntarily. I don't know.
Yeah, no, them.
It was said that the whole army was unremitting in its worship of Bacchus, and Venus followed in Bacchus's train. And what were they later to discover was, of course, that Mercury came soon after. The army had its camp followers, including a large number of prostitutes. But the soldiers soon started falling ill. And this disease was new to both sides. So, as we said, the Italians called it the French disease and the French called it the Italian disease. Mm-hmm. Philippe de Comines thought that it was an opportunity wasted. The French could have been so popular and yet they'd blown their chances. And this is why Comines thought the conquest had been the work of God. Once it was left to the leaders of the French, it all fell apart. They just weren't up to it. And the king had lost control and didn't seem to care. He could be kind and affable, but there was no structure and no consistency. And we should remember that when we come to rate him.
Yes.
He's a complex character. It's going to be very difficult to rate. And this was dangerous because the Aragonese hadn't been completely crushed. There were still enclaves of them around Naples, which the French should have dealt with while they had the chance.
Enclaves of part of the family or just loyalist?
Loyalist
areas?
People, yeah, people who hadn't said one thing and then scarpered. And with the French popularity plummeting, would these enclaves be able to make a comeback? People began to forget how awful it had been and started hankering after the old days. And think how quick this is.
That happens so fast. Like, how?
Everything in the story.
Sorry, I just went totally political in my head. I'm like, they're looking at rehiring Trump.
Yes.
What is wrong with you people? The answer is no.
Yeah. But this story, everything seems to happen at double speed. He gets down there at double speed and he loses it at double speed. Or loses the...
That's because he didn't work for it in the first place.
Yes.
It was just given to him. So he didn't think of, how am I going to keep it now?
Mm. Well, and then suddenly into this hedonistic life that the king, his courtiers and his men were leading, came an event so cataclysmic that it bowled the French for six and made Charles realise that his conquest had been built on shifting sands, to mix my metaphors somewhat. To understand what is happening, we have to go back in time and north in geography. In the summer of 1494, so we're going back about 6 months or so, Philippe de Comines learnt that he was to be the French ambassador to Venice. So in September, he left the French army at Asti and set off for Venice. At that time, the likelihood of Charles being able to take Naples was laughable. And Comines assured the Venetians of his master's friendship and told them that they would never do anything that would be inimical to the liberties of Italy. The king only had two goals, to get back the throne of Naples, which was his by right, and to use the area as a springboard for attacking the Turks. So unless you were a Turk or the king of Naples, you had no reason to worry, and that included the Pope. More secretly, Comines told the Venetians that when Charles took Naples, if they could provide him with 1,000 horse and 10 to 20 galleys, he would repay them with a Neapolitan port.
That sounds like a wine.
Yes. Well, it'd be really good for the Venetians because, I mean, that's what they do. They do trading, don't they? So if they've got a port right down at the bottom, you know, that'd be brilliant. So they did. They went off and thought about it for a while and then came back and told him that they saw no occasion to strengthen the existing alliance. They were sure his main intention was to start a crusade against the Turks, and when he did that, he could count them in. What they didn't say, but obviously meant, was, but don't expect any help from us from any other little projects you might have on the go at the moment.
Ah.
But then Charles swept through Italy and took Naples, and everything changed. In the early spring of 1495, there was a gathering in Venice. And the ambassadors of all the big names were there. The Pope, Maximilian, Ferdinand and Isabella, Ludovico Sforza, the city-states of Pesaro, that's Giovanni Sforza, the first husband of Lucrezia Borgia, Mantua, Ferrara, Rimini, and even the Turks. All of them felt that without the might and wealth of Venice, they're stymied, effectively, Alfonso begged for help and promised to be a better ruler if he could be given another chance.
Oh dear.
The Turkish delegation was there because the Sultan was afraid that Charles would make use of Prince Cem. But obviously, more on that in his cameo episode.
Yes.
But that does explain why the Turks were there.
I did not understand that.
Yes. Ludovico was having serious doubts about the French. And surprisingly, nobody said, although they must have been thinking it, this is all your damn fault. The architect of this plot was Ferdinand. Although he took steps to disguise that fact. It was his House of Aragon that was at threat in Naples, and he didn't want Charles so close to his Sicilian possessions. But we know Ferdinand, and we know that he's always looking after number one. He saw two very different outcomes for Naples. If this was a permanent, stable takeover by France, that would be disastrous for the House of Aragon as a whole. But Charles's conquest didn't feel like that. It had happened too quickly, and it hadn't been shored up. Charles might think he was all that because he'd conquered the place, but he was completely out of his depth. But for Ferdinand, Charles's invasion wasn't such a terrible thing. And he paid lip service to the idea of helping Alfonso get his throne back, but that wasn't really what he wanted. He wanted Naples himself.
Yes.
And it was all going to be perfect. His grandson could have the states in northern Italy that we heard about in that very complicated Ferdinand episode.
Yes.
He'd have Naples. You know, the Spanish were coming. And as long as he could get the French out of Naples, there'd be no reason then to help Alfonso back onto the throne. Charles could weaken them, and then Ferdinand swoops in and takes Naples off Charles.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Alfonso suddenly looks a bit like that little crab sitting at the bottom of the sea, nibbling on a piece of algae, while an octopus creeps out of the crevice behind him.
A much bigger octopus.
One problem, though. Ferdinand had made promises under the Treaty of Barcelona, and that treaty had given him Sedan and Roussillon. But if he played his cards right, he could get Sedan and Roussillon and Naples. Just as Charles had been setting out to France, Ferdinand had sent an ambassador to him just to clarify one or two things. And if you remember from Ferdinand's episode, he was a chess player, so he was always thinking several moves ahead. The ambassador said that Ferdinand was all in favour of the crusade against the infidel. He loved that bit. What he had a problem with was that Charles becoming the King of Naples bit. But if Charles let the Pope arbitrate between him and the House of Aragon, then Ferdinand would happily abide by the findings. But otherwise he must politely decline to be bound by the Treaty of Barcelona, since Naples was a papal fief and the defence of the Pope was paramount. See, it's nothing about I want to have all this land. I want to look after the Pope. That's my main thought. I want to bash the infidel and look after the Pope.
He's not dumb.
He certainly isn't. Meanwhile, while Charles carried on his trek down the Italian peninsula, Ferdinand was building up his navy. And this would transport his army to Naples if and when needed. And leading it would be El Gran Capitan himself, Gonzalvo de Cordoba. Before the French had even reached Naples, Cordoba was waiting in Sicily with 700 cavalry and 6,000 infantrymen. And there were 50 Spanish vessels and a further 500 men waiting for the call in Perpignan. Or Perpignan. But don't think that Ferdinand intended to use this army to attack Charles in Naples. That would be far too straightforward for Ferdinand. He was going to get others to do his dirty work, and he'd just hover about in case he were needed. So he decided to make use of that unholy trinity, fear, envy, and greed. And so he gathered together a group of people who all had reasons to wish Charles out of Italy. There were only two people he couldn't persuade to join, and Florence was one, because they wanted to stay on good terms with the French so they could get Pisa back. And also they were worried that if they went against him, Charles would reinstate Piero de' Medici. And the other person was, of course, Henry VII. For a start, he wasn't willing to put money into what he didn't see as his war. And also he was protecting his throne from Perkin Warbeck and didn't want to risk that nice little nest egg following the Treaty of Etaples.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think the King of Denmark was even asked, but he doesn't appear in this at all.
I read in another book they're talking about how the King of Denmark supported Perkin Warbeck. That's where? Where are you finding this information? Because we didn't.
The other one was Edmund de la Pole, wasn't it, that he was alleged to be supporting? Yeah.
Was supporting. He was going to give him ships to retake England. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
It's a long way to Denmark. I mean, you can't do everything. However, Ferdinand managed to work on the fear, envy, and greed of the other rulers to his own advantage. The Pope was afraid that if the French were to stay in Italy, the papacy would be in bondage to them. He hadn't wanted to go out on a limb by himself, but if there were safety in numbers, he would reconsider. Maximilian needed more tactful handling, because he'd gained land in the Treaty of Senlis, and he didn't want to jeopardise that by backing out of the treaty. Not only that, but Maximilian was already at loggerheads with Venice, as we heard in his episode. Also, he was very keen on that idea of the crusade against the Turks, since he was another one brought up on tales of chivalry. And Maximilian would have been in an alliance with Ludovico. And you'd think he would be anyway, since he was married to Ludovico's niece, Bianca Maria. And he had had that hefty dowry off Ludovico. But Maximilian had provided Ludovico with a diploma, which went some way to giving him the Duchy of Milan. But he also needed that investiture from Maximilian. So very soon after the death of Jean Galeazzo, unseemingly hasty, you'd think, Ludovico sent a message to Maximilian asking for the investiture. He told Maximilian that he'd been using the title Ludovico's Dux, Duke Ludovico, quote, without saying of what we are Duke, unquote. Which seemed a bit much. I'm Duke Ludovico.
Of what?
Yes.
Oh, let's
change the subject.
Yeah.
That Maximilian was reluctant to provide him with the investiture since he thought that Ludovico was being presumptuous, assuming he'd get it. That sounds like a very Maximilian thing, doesn't it?
Yes.
If you ask me for it, you're not going to get it.
No, not going to happen.
Also, the German princes probably wouldn't have agreed, because Maximilian didn't have as much power as he liked to think. And anyway, another reason that Maximilian might not want to join Ferdinand's group was that he didn't have the money.
He never has money.
No. But Ferdinand knew just how to handle Maximilian. He played on the old animosities he'd had with the French, and he had many reasons to feel bitter towards the French. Louis XI had taken much of the inheritance that should have gone to Mary of Burgundy, Maximilian's first wife.
Mm-hmm.
Charles had stolen his second wife, Anne of Brittany, and jilted his daughter, Margaret of Austria, in the process. Ferdinand could drip-feed fears about what Charles was up to now into Maximilian's ears. Charles had admitted that he planned to keep some of the places he'd taken so as to leave channel of communication between France and Naples. And Maximilian saw some of these places as fiefs of the Holy Roman Empire. And furthermore, Andreas Palaiologos had sold his rights to the Byzantine crown to Charles VIII. And he was he wasn't the last emperor of Constantinople, because it fell as His father died in the very last battle, the fall of Constantinople. But he got out and was sort of selling the crown to the highest bidder, it seems.
Why not? He doesn't own it.
Charles VIII bought it. So now Charles was talking about becoming Emperor of the East. And Maximilian felt there should only be one emperor, and it was him.
Me?
Yeah.
Me?
So after all that, there was no way Maximilian wasn't going to join Ferdinand's group.
Yep. Man, he seems so easily manipulated.
The Venetians had been biding their time, waiting to see what would happen, and whether Italy would be destroyed in the process, and they'd be the only state left standing, which they didn't see was necessarily a bad thing. And like everybody else, they thought that Charles didn't have a hope in hell of reaching Naples. They might conquering it.
You're all wrong.
You would think that Charles's intention to start a crusade against the Turks would have swung Venice over to his side. And not so long ago it would have done. But they had reached an accord with the new Sultan, Bajazet, so now they didn't want anyone to antagonise the Turks and start rocking the boats.
Okay.
Yeah, if he'd done this just a few months earlier, you know, the Phoenicians would have been on board, only too happy.
Yeah.
But now they're thinking, oh, I don't think so. Because, mind you, they needn't have worried, because by the time Charles and his men were getting drunk and contracting diseases in Naples, they had forgotten all about this crusade idea. It's not mentioned again.
Really? Yes. They just stopped talking about it?
Yes, it just goes. Oh. Yes. Well, we've done one thing on our to-do list. We'll do the other one. I don't know.
Was there a number two?
I'm not sure there was, actually. However, the Venetians were afraid that just the French presence on Italian soil might make the Ottomans feel that they would have to retaliate, and the greatest loser out of that would be the Venetians. So in February 1495, they agreed to join, probably with some reservations since they didn't like Maximilian and didn't trust Ludovico. Well, probably didn't.
Neither would I.
Didn't trust Maximilian, didn't like Ludovico, I guess either way.
Both.
Yes. And it's possible that Ludovico always intended to change sides the moment Charles stopped being any use to him. I mean, that's the way of the world.
Yes.
While he was weakening the Naples of Ferrante and Alfonso and stopping them being a threat to Milan, Ludovico would stick by him. But once Charles became a powerful force in Naples himself, And he had Louis of Orléans as his sidekick, who'd stayed back in Asti. The man with a greater claim to the Milan than the Sforzas had, Ludovico would have no qualms at all in ditching Charles in favour of the opposition. And since Ludovico had pledged to help Charles financially in his enterprise, he was having to exact taxes from his people, which was making him universally hated. So he started regretting his decision within a month of Charles' arrival on Italian soil.
Yeah.
When the Venetian ambassadors arrived in Ludovico's court at the end of 1494, Ludovico assured them that he had done everything he could to slow the French down or to stop them completely, because it was he who suggested that they attack Sarzana, since he thought it would be so strong they'd be held up there for months. It was hardly his fault it fell so easily. And he'd also told the French to disarm their fleet and leave Genoa. I don't know why Charles would have agreed to do that, but that's what Ludovico claimed he said. So it's almost as if he's trying to pass himself off as a fifth columnist. You know, I was never on Charles's side, really. I was just playing the game and... yeah. But his plan now was that Ferdinand should attack France over the Pyrenees and then Charles would have to go home to sort it out. Because if Venice and Milan tried to do this alone, then all the fighting would be on Italian soil. So it would be much better to relocate this fighting somewhere far from Italy. And I don't blame them. I mean, just get it away from here.
Yeah.
Because I had read that it was Ludovico who had instigated the League of Venice. But it's hard to tell who it was, since we seem to have a sort of vicious or virtuous circle. Ludovico wants Ferdinand in to entice the French away, so he could be said to be creating the League. But it was Venice who came to him to discuss it, so did the Venetians instigate the League? But Ferdinand was already in contact with the Venetians, so did he, in his usual underhanded way, tell the Venetians to make Ludovico think that he had thought of it, so that he'd be completely enmeshed? So I don't know who decided.
I'm going to go with the Ferdinand option.
I think Ferdinand, that... and making everybody yeah. else believe that they had done it, seems very Ferdinandy.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. Yeah, and on the 27th of February 1495, they heard that Charles had taken Naples, so everything suddenly became a lot more urgent. So, if you remember at the beginning of this sidetrack about setting up the League of Venice...
Nope.
Philippe de Comines. It was the bit just after the music. Philippe de Comines was the French ambassador in Venice. He could see that something was going on. I'm not sure he knew precisely what was being planned. The Venetians told him that all the diplomatic activity was to do with attacking the Turks. But Comines wrote to Charles again and again to warn him that something's happening. I don't know what it is, but something is happening. But he received no reply whatsoever. By January, it was being strongly hinted to Comines that he should perhaps leave now.
You need to go.
And it was getting a bit embarrassing for him, since there had been complaints from the Venetians that he never passed on any messages to them. So what was the point of him? And he had to admit, well, there was no point to him because he had no messages to pass on. Nothing was reaching him from Charles. And it was even harder for Comines because he'd never wanted to do this in the first place. He'd been one of the ones who'd been strongly advising Charles not to do it. On the 31st of March, late at night, the League was concluded. And Comines was called in the following day and told that the League had been convened for three reasons: to fight the Turk, to defend Italy, and for the preservation of their states. And he was welcome to pass the news on to his king. And Comines began to panic. He suspected that arrangements had actually gone further than they were telling him, and that Maximilian troops were already on their way. He didn't see how Charles would be able to get out of Italy if that were so. That's what he's frightened of. Everything is closing in. And Charles is down at the bottom. Their nearest port is Genoa, which is right at the top.
Oh, gosh. And even if you manage to get onto a ship, you have to get past Sicily.
Yeah, which has got El Gran Capitan just sitting there waiting for them to do it.
Yeah, and you've got to get past Aragon and Castile, which Ferdinand still has control over.
They've really done it quite cleverly, or he's done it quite cleverly, I think. Ferdinand, he is closing off land and sea. Comyn contacted Louis of Orléans and warned him that Asti should be protected by whatever means, otherwise Charles would get trapped in Italy. And he told him to stress to Charles the need for an immediate retreat before the exits were closed to them. He warned him that Maximilian was on his way, just as soon as the money had been raised for him.
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh.
Poor Maximilian. He's just a laughing stock of everybody, including us.
Bless him.
Yeah. Charles finally sent a message to Venice through Comyn, and his tone was one of a hurt friend who can't understand why suddenly everyone has turned against him.
Oh my goodness.
He had, he said, not kept one place for himself, but had given them all back when he'd finished with them, or at least he was in the process of doing so. And no one could complain about any violence or damage. I think Fivitz Arnold might do. His only objects were to preserve the peace and get at the Turks. And yet everyone was secretly created a club, and he wasn't invited. In fact, they were all ganging up on him. It really does sound as if he cannot understand their actions. So what? What have I done?
I've done nothing. Yes. I am innocent.
Yes, yeah, stop bullying me.
Wow, bullying.
The Doge of Venice said that if Charles left quietly without troubling anyone, he and his troops would be guaranteed safe passage. At this point, all the League wants to do is to shunt Charles and his men out of Italy as quickly as painlessly as possible. They offer safe passage across the land or a fleet to take them to Marseille. Just get out.
Land would be the safer way.
Yeah.
You get on a fleet, you're a prisoner. It's not like you can run away.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you can easily, I don't know, slip overboard while looking over at the fish or something, couldn't you?
Oh my, yeah.
Looking for a mermaid.
It was a siren, called him off the ship. We tried to keep him. We even offered to tie him to the pole.
Stick honey
sorry, the
in
pole,
his ears.
The mast.
Comyn advised Charles that as long as he didn't enter Rome forcibly, as the French was afraid he was planning to do, having intercepted some of his letters which said as much, he was safe to leave, but for goodness sake, get on with it.
Get out!
But we know what happens with leagues. They all had different ways of approaching this problem. Venice was all for getting the French back home and felt it was better to help than to hinder. Ludovico and Maximilian were all for besieging Asti and hemming the French in. And this was mainly because Ludovico couldn't relax while Louis of Orléans was so close at hand. So yet again, yeah, they all club together and say, we're all going to do this together.
But they never do.
But they've got their own home problems.
Yeah.
And I can't help thinking it would be better if they'd gone with Venice's plan. Sounded very sensible.
Yes.
But no, Ludovico gathered 3,000 horse and 4,000 infantrymen to march on Asti. And at the same time, he sent an ultimatum to Louis of Orléans. By reason of Louis's hostile action, it said, Ludovico was forced to occupy Asti. He said he had received from Maximilian the investiture of Milan, so from now on, Louis must address him as the Duke of Milan and must stop using the title himself. I don't know how true that was. I don't think Maximilian has given him the investiture. But, I mean, he's describing himself as Duke Ludovico anyway, so...
Yes, true.
Quite shameless. Ludovico seems to have been under the impression that Asti was virtually defenceless, most of the troops having gone down to Naples. But Comyn had been sending reports back to France, and the Beaujeux were nothing if not efficient. They had gathered together more men and were sending them for the defence of Asti. Had Ludovico set off immediately, he would definitely have won. But he was held back by lack of money, and the fact that the Venetians were advising him against it. Before many weeks, the scales had tipped in Louis's favour. Especially since Ludovico had antagonised the people of Novara by a well-meaning scheme to irrigate the arid wastes around Vigevano, by diverting the water away from Novara. Thus, Novara sided with Louis and let the French troops in. And in fact, that was only part of it. There were few people who weren't disaffected by Ludovico, because he was bleeding them dry, and that never goes down well.
No, it doesn't.
If Louis had carried on to Milan, he probably would have found people lining the streets to welcome him in. And if that had happened, the Venetians might have sided with the French, since they had no love for Ludovico either. And Maximilian and the Pope would have just been hung out to dry. But Philippe could have been strangled at birth. But Louis was too timid. He didn't go straight into Milan. As it was, the Venetians felt that they couldn't let the attack on Novara go unpunished. Otherwise, the French might start looking elsewhere for prime real estate. And, you know, they might start just going from one city to another, just take it over.
And just taking them, yeah.
Also, Louis had shot himself in the foot. Not literally, metaphorically. He'd gone into Novara, he'd been let in there, but he was immediately besieged. And so all those troops he'd used to take the place were effectively taken off the field of play.
Play board, yeah. Mm. They have to stay there and defend.
Yeah. And Louis stuck in there now. He was in Asti, where he, you know, ran the place. Now he's in Novara, where he's a prisoner.
Essentially, yeah.
Then the book I was reading dived down a 2-page rabbit hole about syphilis. But we've already dived there, so we'll leave that.
Yes.
So next week, we will look at the Battle of Fornova and beyond, and whether Charles can get out. Because he has made a miraculous descent through Italy and taken over Naples. Will the reascent be just as easy?
I'm going to go with no. Mm. I know he gets back, but I don't know how hard it is.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, Louis's no use to him. Louis's now being besieged.
Yeah.
Everyone's turned against him. Everyone's ganging up on him, poor man.
Oh, what did I do? I'm polite. Nice.
Yeah, I'm affable. I'm Charles the Affable. So, we'll see next week what happens to him as he heads back up north.
Yeah. Italy cannot be proud of themselves during this time.
No, I think that the fact that they thought that he had God on his side was a massive thing. Once someone starts winning that well, you think, this can't be right.
Yeah.
It must be God's will. And who are we to go against God's will? I'd rather go against whoever your Lord is than God. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the fact that he was going down there to do a crusade. Well, obviously God would side with him.
Yes, the crusade when are you leaving for that crusade?
I'll just have another bottle of wine and then we'll talk about it, I think. Okay. Bring me another woman.
Okay. Ugh.
Yeah. He's probably feeling not too well now, and not many of them. They're all beginning to feel a bit sad. So, yes, because he doesn't take back as many as he went down with. As we learned from the syphilis episode, that a lot of them get left behind. And not just as a garrison. A lot of them are too ill to travel. And the ones that do get back, they've got it as well.
We still need a squishy sound effect. Oh, my beautiful wife.
Yes.
Don't touch me.
That's the trouble. All the women folk that are left behind. Happy reunion. He's not going to be so happy.
No.
Anyway, we've got a nice battle to look forward to next time.
Yeah. Goodbye.
Goodbye.